Welcome, everybody. I've got the pleasure of introducing Jan Leinhardt. He's going to be talking, introducing us to Apache CouchDB. Thanks, Jan.
Thank you. Welcome to my talk, introducing Apache CouchDB 2.0. Focuses on 2.0. Too bad you can't put emphasis in titles, so 2.0 is the big deal here. My name is Jan Leinhardt. I've been with CouchDB since 2006. I've had my 10-year anniversary just a couple of weeks ago. I've been with Apache CouchDB since 2008 because I've been through the graduation within Apache. And I've been the PMC chair and vice president of CouchDB since 2011. And I'm the longest active contributor to the project. I'm also the CEO and co-founder of Neighborhoodie Software. We're doing a bunch of services and support around Apache CouchDB and a lot of other fun things. If you happen to use Node.js a lot, talk to me. I've got some interesting things for you. But today, this is about CouchDB. In the context of CouchDB, I have done everything from evangelizing like this, community work, like figuring out what to do with all the people doing the project, as well as core engineering, and I still do all of the above. We shipped CouchDB 2.0 on September 20th this year, so it's just a couple of weeks old. And it was a major, major milestone in the history of CouchDB. And that becomes clear in a second, too. It is fulfilling the 12-year vision and development of the project from its inception going forward. So the 2.0 milestone is really big. So I'm spending, well, we'll spend most of the time about the things that are interesting, about that how all the, like, the 10, 12 years of work come together into one thing. So this is also where I stop speaking slowly, because it turns out when I timed the talk, I'm getting really close to the allocated 50 minutes. If there's something where I'm going to resume, and you don't understand what I'm saying, please raise your hand and I'll repeat what I said, because when I'm trying to get through the slides really quickly, it turns out I'm going to mumble. So I need some interaction from you at that point. So let's get started. This is the marketing blurb. CouchDB has seamless multi-master sync synchronization that scales from big data to mobile with an intuitive HTTP JSON API and designed for reliability. Lots of buzzwords. Really good. Good marketing pitch there. Well done, team. I'm that team. I wrote that. There are a lot of interesting things that you can do with CouchDB, and I think the best way to approach this is through going through three distinct use cases of how you can use CouchDB. And when we're through all of those, everything else kind of falls into place, I hope. So let's get started. The three use cases. The first one, if you need a database, CouchDB is a really good general-purpose database. Most projects just need a database, and CouchDB is as good as any other of them. Only when projects get more specific, they need more general, like more special purpose solutions, and we'll get to them in a second. But just fundamentally, it's a decent general purpose database. So when you go and look for things to use, consider CouchDB. Thanks. Number two, it's a highly available and scalable big data cluster. Again, good amount of buzzwords in there. So this is already a specialization, one of the things that I talked about just a minute ago. If you need something that's highly available as a data store, or if you need something that's scalable or can hold lots amounts of data, or truly big data, there's clustering technology built into CouchDB that you can use as well. And number three, as a use case, is seamless mobile-to-cloud data synchronization. I'll go into much more detail about what that exactly is in a second. But these are like three distinct use cases of how you can use CouchDB. And you can mix and match any one of those as well. You can start with one, move to the other. Maybe when you start out a project, you maybe don't have high availability needs. You could grow into a cluster. Then you get mobile clients, and you can make use of the technology inside CouchDB there as well. And there is, again, data synchronization between all of these use cases. And especially the mobile to cloud data sync. I don't think I have to tell anyone here that mobile is kind of a big deal. We're done with this. Mobile is here now. It is the big deal now. And here's the thing about mobile data, though. Most mobile data is offline for battery reasons. Our battery technology is so advanced that the nice phones that we all have in our pockets get barely a day of charge. And the only way they can get there is because the chips in there, the radios, are usually not on. So if you're like streaming over LTE, you don't get a day of like battery life on your phone. So the only way to make this work, that the job of the radio that makes the data transmission, the job of that chip is to emit energy into the ether. That energy comes out of the battery. The only reason we get any battery life is that they don't work most of the time. So most mobile phones, even the most advanced ones, are mostly offline most of the time. That's the number one thing to know about mobile data. The second is almost 60% of mobile is on 2G. And this sounds like an antiquated statistic, but that's from the Google Developer Summit last week. So this is reality and it's very painful. Not everyone is on LTE. For example, I live in Berlin, one of the most highly developed places on Earth. We have LTE in the subway and it sometimes works. So even if I'm not in the, I'm in the woods or on the mountains, like in my, like in capital city, I still have spots where I don't have broadband mobile internet. So two things to remember for this use case. Couch2B helps you to build compelling applications in the face of spotty networks. That means you can have a full set of data on mobile devices that users can interact with interactively, have low latency access to the data because it's on local host. It's the lowest latency host available on a mobile phone. So you can have fast user experience. There's numerous studies that delays of even 100 milliseconds in user interfaces make people stop engaging with your app, usually in the context of online shopping, where you can like put money where that is. But if you have applications that people need to use, if they are slow, that doesn't make any, like that people stop using them. And if they have to wait for a 2G connection to come up, it's helpless and people stop using your app. Second, that same scenario, the most of the data that lives on the device, say I'm going around and tracking a bunch of stuff, we want to have that go back to the cloud for big data analysis because there's a whole lot of stuff. All the other technologies shown here and yesterday, today and yesterday, do a whole lot of interesting things with the pile of data that we collect, but we somehow need to get that from the phones into the cloud, and Couch2B allows you to bridge that gap and get the data back. All right. This is very, very high level. Let's step one level down. Couch2B is a decent general purpose database. Bunch of the basics about Couch2B, and all the basics apply to all the use cases, but this is just like the how it roughly works and how you use it. The main protocol to talk to Couch2B is HTTP. I don't think we're at a position where I have to argue that that's a good idea. HTTP is a great protocol. There's maybe arguing about which version of HTTP to use. Currently, we are supporting HTTP 1.1. HTTP 2 support is in the works, of course. HTTP is universally understood, has support in all programming environments. There's dedicated hardware and software to do all sorts of failover metrics, load balancing, all sorts of things that you want to do with it. And if you go to your operations team and say, hey, I have a piece of software that speaks HTTP, can you integrate it into our stack? They will say yes, because they will already have some other service that speaks HTTP. So it's really easy convincing ops to start with Couch2B. Number two, data storage is JSON. We store in JSON. JSON is the lingua franca of data exchange today. It's a little bit more lightweight than XML. The genius thing about JSON is not that it tries to be able to model all the data structures in all the languages, but it is the subset of all the primitive types that are in every programming language. Numbers, types, strings, lists, and hashes, or maps, booleans, and somewhat numbers, shake hands. If you know JSON really well, you know the rough edges. But in general, this is very nice. You have a Java object, serialize it into JSON, deserialize it into Python, and use it as an object there right away. You don't have to have any translation layers. Especially, you don't have to have an ORM that translates your objects where you're programming into a relational database schema and back and forth. And the more you grow, the less this is useful. It's a true story, but at some point, the Couch2B 1x release had half the amount of line of codes than Active Record, the ORM in Rails. So if you count like defects in production code, on number of lines of codes, Couch2B was half as big as the ORM to make other code just work like you would have a JSON data store. We call them the JSON data documents. Think of them as a data record, a row in an RDBMS or a Word document, an email, something that's a logical, bound together thing. There's other databases that call themselves document databases. They've stole the term from us. We stole the term from Lotus Notes. Don't tell anyone. please. But there's a whole lot of other databases that do this as well, so I assume the paradigm is somewhat familiar. Two things unique to CouchDB, how we are addressing documents. First, unique IDs. By default, CouchDB address gives records unique IDs, but you can give them your own if you have external IDs that you know are unique. But within a database, they are enforced to be unique. And then for different versions of the same document, we have content addressable revisions that are stored in a list and a bunch of other things that I'll explain in more detail later. But this is how we address a specific document or data set in CouchDB and even the difference of the different versions of those data sets. Next. So far we have IDs and JSON, so it's a bit of a key value store. So CouchDB is a decent key value store too, but from a database you usually expect some more querying capabilities. CouchDB has, in my view, and if I'm wrong, please tell me, a unique incremental persistent MapReduce implementation for building indexes and queries. The incremental and persistent bit, the unique bit, the MapReduce part, I assume everybody knows here. This is a big data conference. I'm not going to explain MapReduce. I hope that's okay. If you want to know, please talk to me later. And then I'll go through an example of how this actually works later as well. Another really interesting high-level bit is what we call the changes feed. It works like Git log or SVN log. It gives you a list of all the things that ever happened in your database with an index. So you can ask the question, what happened since? And you can take note, okay, maybe you need to like go through all the documents in your database and do something with them. It's like, I don't know, send an email for every one of those. Poor person who receives all those emails, but say, bear with me. And then you process the first 10 emails, and then the email sending process crashes for some reason. But it remembered, I've already processed 10 of those. So the next time the process starts, it can ask the database, give me everything after the first 10 that I already have. So I can build like deltas from the things that happened in the database. Plus, I can plug into this again. This is all HTTP. Get a real-time feed. Just have an open socket to CouchDB and just gives me a line of JSON for every document that comes into the database. So I can build a pipeline into other streaming systems if I want to. So CouchDB persists everything and then sends everything elsewhere. So integration with other systems is really nice that way as well. And here's one that's really, really important and that we have worked a lot on, is that the single node version of CouchDB is API compatible with a cluster version. In fact, there's no two different versions. A single node CouchDB cluster is just a cluster. A single node instance of CouchDB is just a cluster with just one node. So you can start out with a single node CouchDB, and when your data needs, your availability requirements change, then you can move to a cluster without having to rewrite your database. And I think that's really, really important. There's other databases, and I command them as well, that put all sorts of features into the databases to make developers start using the database. It's a natural thing to do, right? Developers want a thing, you build the feature, so they use their database. Thing is, if you design a system on a single computer that controls all the processes and memory and everything, you can do a lot of shortcuts and implement a lot of interesting things that will not work once you move to distributed systems running on multiple machines, adding a network. Anyone who's familiar with the fallacies of distributed networking will know what I'm talking about. And then with the other databases, the more data you put in there and the more requests they get and the more you scale them out, the more features stop working correctly or as fast as you need them. So you have to constantly adapt your application to no longer use many of the good features that these databases have built in to get the developers in as your application gets more critical. And that's the least point where you want to rewrite your application, especially for convenient features. So with CouchDB, it's the reverse. We don't put in any features in CouchDB 1. And it's a lot of restraint you have to put in. Like you have a single node database and you don't put in a feature that everybody wants. Because you know once you move to a distributed system, this feature will no longer be guaranteed to work correctly or as fast as we need it to. The trade-off is that we don't have as many nice features as other databases, but we know every single one of those features will work at scale. So if you need that guarantee, CouchDB is a good choice for you. Speaking of design decisions, the number one trade-off for CouchDB is, or the number one thing that's most important for CouchDB is data safety. If you tell CouchDB, hold this for me, and CouchDB tells you, I got it. CouchDB will forever keep this, and only if your hardware goes bad, that data can be lost. In the 2.0, in the clustered sense, that is even stored redundantly. So there's a whole lot of things that need to go wrong before you lose your data. And CouchDB trades everything for data safety. Like, we really, really strongly believe in this. And I'm going into a lot more detail of how this is actually implemented later. It's built around fault tolerance. And it's built in Erlang. Erlang is an obscure programming language that I hope some of you know that was built around the concept of fault tolerance. Imagine a database server that has 1,000 requests, clients hammering at it in parallel, doing all sorts of database things. And there's always errors that happen. Things go wrong all the time. So one of these 1,000 clients may produce an error inside the server. And then only this client and the CouchDB subsystem that serves this request may throw an exception, throw an error, and return this back. None of the 999 requests that are going on concurrently will ever even know that there was another request, let alone that there was an error. They're logically isolated within the Erlang virtual machine. So this is really well suited to highly concurrent work, but also highly isolated work. So whenever something happens, none of the other things go bad. This is really, really, really crucial for us as well. This may sound rough, but CouchDB had the crash-only design. There's a Microsoft paper from, 12 years ago, where they studied whether it's worth having a shutdown procedure for Windows or just a fix-up procedure on startup. And it turns out the fix-up procedure is a lot faster than waiting for shutdown procedures to get all the data in the consistent state and stuff. So after that, a whole lot of, a class of crash-only design systems came up, and CouchDB was designed this way as well. And it takes it to an extreme, in fact. At any point in time, the data inside CouchDB is in a consistent state on disk. In any catastrophic failure, power outage, out of memory, CouchDB crashes, kernel crashes, whatever, all the things that can go wrong, CouchDB is designed to survive this. In fact, there's no shutdown procedure in CouchDB. The regular way, the stop script for CouchDB is kill PID, or kill all CouchDB. There's no extra shutdown procedure, no buffers to flush, no nothing. The advantage of this is when you start up CouchDB again, it's just there. There's no waiting for my ISAM check to come through after the weekend of checking the thing, or InnoCheck, or whatever else you're using to fix up the data that was gone wrong, that may have gone wrong. There are a bunch of long-running processes, building indexes, garbage collection, that kind of stuff that run inside CouchDB. All of these processes are resumable with regular checkpoints. So you only, at worst, lose a small window of repeatable computation, and you can usually kick off where you started. And all of the operations in CouchDB are idempotent. Reads, of course, are idempotent, but also write requests by the nature of the IDs and content addressable hashes inside the data. If you make a request twice to the same database, it still looks like you made that request only once. So these design decisions really help to build a reliable system. So let's do a bit of a checklist. General purpose database, web server or API server these days, an app server, CouchDB in the back. Works, great, check. We had a green check mark. That's pretty good. So we get a bonus with this. And again, I'll explain it in detail in a bit. But I mentioned seamless master-master replication. So we can do this as well. Say we have a server here in the EU and one in the US. Maybe we want to have all the app server and the clients go through the intercontinental lag for every request. So we have a server on each side. They can replicate back and forth so everybody can have all the data. But you can get geodistribution built in just like this. Because this already works, generically, or is implemented generically, when you start getting customers in Africa or users in Africa, you can just keep going like this, age out, just add another one. They can also, I didn't draw the arrows, but you can also have them replicate back and forth. I'll show that in a bit. So that works, cool. Next, the scalable cluster. Same situation, but we want to make sure. By the way, anybody know what CouchDB stands for? It, of course, is an acronym. Cluster of Unreliable Commodity Hardware. So these are a bunch of flimsy virtual machines that are really cheap, maybe, that our CouchDB cluster runs on. And if one of them dies, the other two will still be able to handle all the data that you need until you replace the other one. So cluster here works. We get a check mark. That's really good. That's the fault tolerant bit. Now, in reality, this usually looks like this. You have a front-end server tier that is highly available, an app server tier that's highly available, and then the cluster becomes really useful at that point as well. And then we can grow the cluster as well. So I doubled the size of the cluster here. I can do this at runtime if I want to. So if I now have need to store more data that can fit on the original cluster, or if I need to handle more requests than fit on the original cluster, I can grow the cluster there as well. So that works. Great. And that still works in the geodistribution case. It can be a single node machine, cluster machine, so I can slowly grow out my system as needed, however I need. I can grow them there as well, in parallel, not in parallel. Say the US is growing faster than the EU or the other way around, probably now, then you can do this independently as well. So that works as well. We get another green check mark. Great. Cool. So next use case, number three, mobile. I have tens, hundreds, thousands, millions of mobile clients. CouchDB is capable of handling per device or per user databases. Logical databases within the server can be hundreds of thousands, is fine. So every device is connected to its own database and does data synchronization back and forth. There is a whole lot of interesting things happening in the space of mobile. We also started the offline first movement, if you ever heard about this, thinking about the user experience implications, the data technology implications. If you're following web development at all, there's a movement called progressive web apps that may bring offline capabilities to the web, to web standards. And the data synchronization that CouchDB brings is kind of the next step after this. When you get all the assets working offline, you can also get the data working offline. So the nice thing is when I have the data on the phone, like I said before, I have a snappy user experience. I don't have to wait for any server round trips, everything. But in the end, I can collect everything on the server side or on the cloud side to do big data analysis there as well. So another check mark. Plus bonus, if that all goes away, it still all works. I just want to use the effect once per slide, once per presentation. And again, geodistribution works as well. So if you don't want to speed things up for EU customers over here, that works as well. Great. Another check mark. That's another big idea. All right, so this is not as high level in the beginning, a little bit more high level. We'll step down another level now. Maybe I'll drink something to get a breather. All right, this is what CouchDB 1 looks like. There's a data storage layer. There's a synchronization protocol on top of this. At the same level, there's the persistent MapReduce index subsystem and an HTTP layer. It's fairly straightforward. Code looks like this as well. It's really, really easy to understand. It's fairly easy to understand once you identified all the parts. CouchDB 2 doesn't look a lot different. This is CouchDB 2, CouchDB 1, CouchDB 2. So all that we added is the clustering layer and a query language on top of the MapReduce. So I guess we all here love to program MapReduce, but for some developers, it's kind of icky. So we made a declarative query language that compiles into MapReduce. So we're still using the same subsystem, but you can use it declaratively instead of, what's the opposite of declaratively? Programmatically. And now this is where the whole synchronization ecosystem of CouchDB becomes really interesting. This is what PouchDB looks like. PouchDB is a full implementation of CouchDB in JavaScript targeted for web browsers. And as interesting as that might sound, it works really well, and we have really interesting use cases that I'll show you at the end. It uses persistent in-browser storage, has an abstraction layer for the different in-browser storages. If you know anything about this, no browser agrees on which is the best one. The web is awesome like this. It has the synchronization protocol. It has the persistent and incremental MapReduce. It has the query language and a native JavaScript API. It works in all modern browsers. It is competitive in size and allows you to build fully offline capable web applications. And I'll show you a bunch of those in the towards the end. And this works in native mobile. So if you're still building native apps, the same thing still also exists for iOS and Android in Objective-C and Java, respectively. There's persistent on-storage device, the synchronization protocol, the persistent MapReduce indexes. One of them has their own query language, which is different from our query language, which is the fun thing that you get with competition. But then you have competition, which is also good. And then they have native iOS and Android APIs. So for all the major platforms that are in use today, there is a CouchDB synchronization implementation available for you. If you're really adventurous, the PouchDB version even runs inside Node.js on the server side. If you need something that is purely in JavaScript on the server, this is less interesting for like big production installations, but more for testing, development, CI. But also, if you're going into the, dare I say, serverless infrastructure things, the more lightweight things. But where this is more real is, I'm dropping this later. I'm keeping you hanging here. There's another buzzword coming in. So let's look at a bunch of topologies. Single node, CouchDB, and I'm now using the CouchDB logo to signify either a single node instance or a cluster. I'm not doing the clustered separation anymore. It could be either one of those. So this is a typical setup that you could do. Single database and a hot spare. Could be different availability zones on your cloud provider. Could be different cities, whatever you want. Before I go into the other topologies, let's explain how that actually works. Our application works in detail. And this is very brief. Bear with me. We have a database, and we're writing a document with the ID 1 and the revision A, the first version of it, into the database. We're updating this document for a new, I hope you can all see in the back, we're updating this document to a new revision B. And you already see, and I'm removing the ref here for brevity reasons, but you already see CouchDB doesn't store document 1, ID 1, revision B in here, but B comes after A. So this revision isn't B, but BA. When we update the document again, we get a new revision called C, which we know comes after B, comes after A. So we always know the logical progression of which version happened after which other version, kind of you also know in a version control system for source code. Now, when we replicate this, CouchDB will use its changes feed that I've explained already that can tell you what happened since in the database and just walk through the changes feed for all the documents that are in this database, move them over to the other database. And specifically, move only the latest revision over. CouchDB only ever replicates the latest revision away. Why that happens, I'll explain later as well. So now on the other database, we have a document, CBA, that just looks like this one. And I can write to this other database as well, creating a new revision, DCBA, and maybe another one, EDCBA, and replicate that back. And now it becomes clear why we keep the history and the order of versions. Because at this point, CouchDB knows that EDCBA is a logical successor of CBA, because these are the same. So this can just be inserted as the latest version of the document with the ID 1. In Git terms, this is a fast forward. So I can just keep going. Now, I write a new document and a new version over here, F, but since it's multi-master, I can write a new version over there as well, but it's H, so I'm making two different changes. What happens now? Anybody guesses? We're replicating. And what CouchDB does at this point is it sees that these two versions have the same history up to E, puts them in here, but then sees F and H are in conflict. And once you start dealing with distributing systems, a conflict is a natural state of data. There's nothing scary about this, just how this is. And CouchDB will mark this inside the JSON as well. It looks like this. The ID is 1. We have a conflict array there now so that you see the data that you're currently using. There's an alternate reality for this document as well. And now it's up to the application to resolve this conflict. Can go in, say either F is the one that I want, H is the one I want, or it can merge it based on application-specific rules to get to the latest, to resolve the conflict. Once the conflict is resolved on one node and we replicate again, the conflict resolution will also replicate to the other side as well. One speciality here is, you all know conflicts from version control systems where Git or SVN put in these markers that are guaranteed to not compile in any compiler, so you hopefully never commit them, hopefully. In an online database, you can't make records unavailable just because they're in conflict. So in CouchDB, we'll pick one of the versions arbitrarily to be the latest version, and if the same conflict happens on multiple nodes in a cluster, it will always pick the same winning revision. So you always have a consistent state of the conflict, but you also always get the marker that you have to resolve it later. I'm going to go into way more detail about this if you're ever interested in my talk, the Apache CouchDB Sync Deep Dive, tomorrow at 12, or if you're here for ApacheCon EU later this week on Thursday, 10:30, I'm doing it again. So it's about like 40 minutes of me just going through this slide over and over again and explaining all the edge cases. So this is just a high-level overview of how the synchronization works. And if you have any questions, we can talk after. So back to topologies. Maybe I have to scale my read requests. Many other databases can do this as well. It's very easy. This is where it gets fun. We just showed you in the example. I can have multi-master databases going on. Some databases support this. This is where most other databases just throw their hands. It's like, we don't support this. In CouchDB, this is just normal mode of operation. And this doesn't even have to be in the same like low latency data center. This can be different regions in your cloud provider. This can be different cities in your local offices. Say you have a Surveyor office, a New York office, and a Tokyo office, and a customer relationship management app that runs locally, but that needs access to all customer data. But you don't want the people in Tokyo wait for the latency to go to Sevilla or New York for getting their data. You can have CouchDB replicate in the back, but everybody gets low latency access to all the data. So this is really, really nice. Here's another, by the way, all of the examples that I show come from real world applications that people have used CouchDB in. Here's another one that we're currently designing and building. Say you have a federal system. Every city is, Germany, for example, is responsible for maintaining and developing the public buildings like streets and bridges. So they all have a database and management software to hand out specific jobs to engineering offices and like have the actual road work done. And no other city trusts any other city with their data, of course. But then on a county level, we need to know what's going on. So we're synchronizing all the data into the county's database, but no county trusts any other county with the data. So they have the aggregate on county level to do planning and budgeting maybe for the specific city or for inter-county connections, or inter-city connections, but you never cross county boundaries here. And then, of course, the same needs to happen on the state level. Maybe that's more policy and analytics of what is actually happening. And on the national level, it's probably just statistics to know what's going on in the federal system. But this way, we can build a whole lot of like nice infrastructure to get all the data up and down however we need it. This could also be corporate structure. This is a supermarket chain in Italy. Every till runs a CouchDB. They all get replicated into a store. The same is true for a different company that I can't name that does point-of-sale systems, including mobile handhelds. So you've seen waiters running around with Android tablets taking your order. Not all of them, but some of them run CouchDB. Sometimes you have really, like in Berlin, underground clubs are really the hype. There's no good Wi-Fi in old bunkers. So you need to be able to take orders when offline with people, but then go back to where you can replicate within the store to the central database for your for stock reasons and for statistical reasons. And then again, the stores can replicate things up to the region and to the corporate level for insights there. And maybe at the top level, we do, again, our big data analytics to see what actually is going on. So this is fun. The next one is going to look ridiculous, but bear with me. It's the big mesh. And this gets interesting in the context of Internet of Things. And maybe it's less the consumer Internet of Things, where like I have a bunch of, in quotes, lots of quotes, smart devices in my home, but there are a handful. Think more industry of things, where I have a lot of small devices with sensors on them that are spread across an oil refinery to do all sorts of measurements. I'll go into that detail later. This is where this becomes actually interesting. Before we go there, because I really like to leave you hanging for a bit, let's talk about clustering internals, because that's one of the things that we did new in 2.0. We need a bit of glossary to get started. The whole system is based on Amazon Dynamo. If you haven't read that paper, please do. It's really fun. It's a good read. A cluster consists of nodes on the physical level, so actual hardware or virtual machines that run CouchDB software. And then on the logical level, there's databases and shards. Databases are sharded across nodes. Shards are assigned to nodes. The map of this assignment is dynamic, so you can move shards around in the cluster as you need. This is how you grow things out as well. We're using consistent hashing to figure out which document ID needs to live in which shard. So the document ID gets put into a hash function, that puts out the shard ID. So here I have a cluster that has a database, database one with three shards, each shard on one of the nodes, shard one, two, and three. This box doesn't actually exist. This is just the logical aggregate of the three shards. So this is no, this has no physical representation. This is just our logical idea of interacting with the database. So if I'm writing a document ABC to database one, the doc ID is run through the hash function. It'll return shard one in this case, and we write the document into shard one. So that works. Another level of this is not only our database is sharded, so only like each node only has to have a part of the data. That's how you store more data than fits on a single machine. But also, CouchDB stores backups for your database, and you can specify how many per database if you want. The default is two. So you have I'm not going to say primary. You have a shard, and you have like the same shard on a different node again. So if that node dies, this one can take over. And because if you're already in a failure situation, you still need to be available, so that's the third one. But if you have data that only needs to live on one shard or data that needs to live on 10 shards because you're really paranoid, you can set that as well. And now, like, so you set the number of backup copies per database, but at request time, you can say how many of them to actually use, and you can make a trade-off between speed and consistency. So the parameter is one for, is n for number of nodes, and in this case it's one. So we want to get document ABC from node B. Since all the all shards live on all nodes here, and I only have to satisfy that one node participates in the query here, I can like node B can just look up the document at its own copy of the shard and return it back to the client. This is really quick because I don't have to talk to any of the other nodes in the cluster. And so I can have a low latency request. But what could have happened conceivably is like while this request or just before this request came in, another client wrote two versions of document ABC, wrote one new version of document ABC to both node A and node C. So you may get out of date data here, but you get it fast. And you can make that trade off at query time, or the application can decide whether it needs something fast or more up to date. So if you say the same scenario, but n equals 2, the requirement now is that this request will have to have two nodes participate in returning the data to you. It'll look into its own database, its own shard, and sees its version, its own specific version, and will ask both other nodes to give them whatever version they have. And they will return both, but whichever one, say node C comes in first and says it has the same version that node B has stored locally, then node B says, okay, n equals 2 is satisfied, I can return this back to the client. Say node C returns one, but it's a newer version of the document, and then node B says, okay, n equals 2 isn't satisfied, waits for node A to come in, node A says, I also have the new version. At that point, node B says, I guess you two have the right version. Now, these two now satisfy n equals 2 and return the new version to the client and at the same time update its own shard with a new version. This is called read repair in the details of Dynamo. So this is how that is. So then you can make sure you can get the latest data or a quorum across the cluster, or just really quickly if you need, like if it's cache data or like timeline data or something like that, it's okay if it's out of date for another second because a human is going to refresh that Twitter timeline anyway. But sometimes you'd really need the consistent view because you need to show the user what they just saved. Same with put. It's the same diagram. If I'm writing n equals 2, put this actually wrong. we'll be writing to node B, write it here. We'll also ignore these two lines. We'll write it to node C and then return because then n equals 2 is satisfied by write requests. So again, you can choose to write 1 if you just need, like, if you're not very sensitive about the data, you can write it to a single node. And then with n equals 3, Couch will actually write to all the three nodes and only return to the client when data has been committed to disk on all nodes. It can be extra, extra secure that the data is definitely, definitely there. All right. One of the fun bits, the incremental, persistent, map, reduce. Again, I'm not explaining map, reduce in detail. I'm just going through an example to show the unique bits of CouchDB. We have a database with 5 records. Document ID A, B, C, D, and E. We're tracking expenses. and the type of expense. Rent, groceries, went to a concert, groceries again, and I took the subway home. I want to know how much I'm spending. I can create a map. I'm creating a map index over the type with a value amount. This is a sorted key value list. Now I have a list of all the types of expenses that I've had in order, like in alphabetical order of the name of the type. So if I want to go in and say, give me all the groceries expenses that I had, Gatsby can go in here and get that part of the index out real quick, or just the rent, and we'll get that out as well. So like, imagine just like millions of rows. It's very efficient to get the specific versions out. So this is very good to get like, this is a general purpose secondary indexing system. The interesting bit now is that the reduce comes in, and the reduce is available in multiple versions. The one is per key, it's grouped by key. So the concert's still $30. The groceries now are combined into one entry. All groceries together were $90, and rent and transit are separate again. So you see the group here. But what also happens at the same time, we also keep the running total of all the expenses that we have that aren't grouped by key. And the fun thing here is all of this is persisted on disk. So the database lives in database.couch. It's a single file in the file system. And the map and reduce values, the list here and the values here, are in a database, in a file called typeAmount.view. In reality, it's a hash, but this is easier to read for you. And here's how this looks. So this is the persistent bit. The incremental will become clear in a second. So this is how this looks on disk, logically in a tree. So all of these, are, all the data storage and indexes are B+ trees in CouchDB. So all data is stored in the nodes. So here, at the lower level, we have our the map index that we just saw in the middle column: concert, groceries, rent, and transit. And in the middle, in the intermediate nodes of the B tree, and please apologize, this isn't a B tree. B tree looks way different, but this is just for example. The inner nodes here calculate the intermediate values. So the groceries, we already know, are 90. The concert and the groceries is 120. The rent and the trend, that is 1,004. And all of this together is 1,124. Now, imagine the B-tree is very shallow and very wide in our case. I think 1,600 nodes per level. That means for millions, hundreds of millions of entries, you have at most a level of 5. So this is very shallow and very wide in reality. So we're adding in one new data entry. So we went to a concert again. It cost $20. We put it in here. So all CouchDB has to do is insert this into the tree here, go one level up, and recalculate with the new data and the already existing data and this data that the new value is 140. And then it needs to update this data with these two to the new running total of 1144. If you imagine having millions of records in here and having just one enter here, this just gets appended. This is not a lot of computation going on for updating the whole index value that we have. So we have an incrementally updatable, persistent, map-reduced index that we can query like we can query any other database indexes. So this is very efficient to update, very fast to query. That's just how that works. It's very cool. For people who aren't very familiar with writing MapReduce and they kept complaining, we wrote a MongoDB-inspired query language. This is what it looks like. There's a selector. This is kind of the where statement in SQL. The fields is the select statement, like what kind of data you want to have out of it, sorting options and pagination options. None of this should be surprising. It just looks a little bit ugly. I'm not a fan, but that's what it is. And that internally compiles to the same MapReduce that you just saw. So all the benefits you get just with declarative language. All right, I've got 5 minutes for one more fun bit. We'll get there. All right, so the data storage. This is the same. So we're looking to how CouchDB stores data on file. Each database is a single file on disk, or in the clustered version, each shard is a single file on disk. It has two indexes, the by ID index, that's just the key value lookup, the by sequence index, that's the changes feed, like what happened when. And this is what the B tree is going to look like, an empty database, it's just a root node. And this is what this looks like on the file system going forward. creating an empty database. There's something called a footer. The name is footer. The naming becomes clear in a second. So we're writing a new document B, document ID B. So the ID index will get the document B. The sequence index will get document B. And on the tree level, we're writing document B in here and creating a new root node to write to it. Because remember, CouchDB never updates any data that has already been committed to disk. So we're not updating the original root. We're creating a new one and have it point to the new database. On the file system layer, you can see this. We have originally just the footer. We're writing document B. We're writing the by ID index, the by sequence index. And we're writing a footer at the end. So when CouchDB opens the file, it starts reading from the back, finds the footer, which has pointers into both our indexes, depending on which query I'm running, which points to the actual data. At that point, then you see nothing actually points to the old footer again, still. So this is garbage data that lives in your database. We're writing a new document called A. In the by ID index, we now store A and B. The by ID index is sorted, by the way. The by sequence index, it's BA because A came after B. And now, again, instead of writing the new version in and adding it to the root node, we're adding a new root node that points to both versions here. And the file system version, writing in a footer that points to the new B-tree indexes, which then point to the original data here, but it jumps over the original intermediate index bits. And again, we have a footer in there that's no longer referenced, so that's garbage. One more, same procedure, writing C at the end, creating a new root node, or intermediate node at this point, I guess, in the actual implementation, and adding ABC there. And again, the footer in the middle is no longer referenced. Now, this all moves one way up. We're writing a new version of B star. In the by ID index, we store B star in here. Now it's A, B star, C. And the by sequence is A, C, B star, because all ID only occurs once in the by sequence index and only with the latest revision. In the tree, again, we write a new node that points to the new version. And on disk, you now see that whole, the index bits and the data for the previous version is garbage data in your database. So the whole downside of the upside of this is we only write to the end of the file. We always go with the spinning disk. It's always fast, or in SSD terms, we always make block allocation, like big block allocations. And we never overwrite any data, but we're accumulating garbage. So in CouchDB version 1, we have to run something called compaction or vacuum in other databases. It's a very simple copy running through the by sequence index, copy all the live data in batches into a new file and then swapping the files. It's very simple. So the first batch is A and C, writing the index bits, and writing B, writing the index bits. CouchDB 2, we optimized this a little bit. We're writing all the documents to the beginning of the file and creating the index in a separate file at the same time and then add the index data at the end. That means we don't have intermediate index bits in there, so the data base is even smaller than before, and this is all clustered and faster to read. All right, I got about 30 seconds for the fun case studies. Do I get a couple more minutes from the host? Okay, I'll be quick. So the first one I want to talk about is IBM CloudEnd uses CouchDB technology to run a big data as a service database platform. You can store lots of data with CloudEnd. It works really well. The second one is called eHealth Africa, where we used a PouchDB, remember, in the browser on the mobile phone device to build app for first responders in the Ebola crisis last year, or 2015. Because in West Africa at the time, there wasn't even no LTE. There was no phone network and no power. There was no discussion about devices being offline. But we helped making first responders more efficient, helping more people in the outbreak. And we know now we kind of, like, that outbreak is over now, and we partly helped. That was really cool. Next one is I'll skip over this one. Rapid FTR is family tracing reunification in crisis regions. For example, in the previous Haiti earthquake, a lot of bad people go into crisis regions and steal children. The Rapid FTR project is a global database of lost children, missing people, mostly children, and trying to get them back together. And of course, in a crisis region, you have no infrastructure. You need to be working offline. Decision for Heroes, or D4H, same principle, but Coast Guards in Ireland and now internationally. If you're doing Coast Guard rescue missions, you can't rely on reliable data there, but you still need to have digital assistant, like software that helps you organize the rescue effort. So you have local Wi-Fi set up everywhere and a network operating center in one of the cars or in the trucks. But each of the rescuers then has a phone and digital device and sensors and trackers that get all collaborated in the local center for faster decision-making. Avalanche protection, this is in the Swiss Alps, the villages the bottom part between two mountains, the valleys, right? And the valleys need to be protected, so there's lots of protections up there. And there's no LTE in the Swiss Alps, there's no 3G, there's no 2G, there's no 1G, there's just no phone. There's no ecological or economical reason to ever put broadband on there. And currently you have inspectors going there with a clipboard and a photo camera and a GPS tracker in their third hand to do inspections of these like crucial bits of infrastructure, taking photos, writing things down, taking it back into the valleys, handing it over to the engineers who go fix them. We made a digital version of this on tablets. That was one tablet, does the GPS for us. You can take high-res photos offline. When you're back in your office, synchronize them back and have an automatic workflow go into getting the engineering going. And finally, that's the last bit. I'm done in a second. The industry of things that I've talked about, 14% of all industrial facilities, like oil refineries, car plants, that kind of stuff, only 14% are internally networked, and less than 20% of those 14% are connected to the public internet. And now imagine you have a company, and this is a client we're working with that I can't name, that has a lot of small devices, Internet of Things type stuff, but with sensors for big industries like this that can put them everywhere to measure everything for efficiency, for emergency things and all that kind of stuff. But they, all the small devices, can do Wi-Fi and have a mesh network with each other, and maybe eventually reach like the headquarter or like the office building of the plant, which maybe has a satellite uplink, or somebody comes by with a thumb drive every week. That's the internet uplink here. But eventually all the data that gets collected here can be put in a cloud instance, and you can have that collected for big data analysis to get all the benefits of the locally generated data, but with the analysis on the cloud there. With that, oops, I skipped this one. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed this. If you have any questions, let me know. I'll be around. And if you want to learn more about the sync, talk tomorrow at 12. Thank you very much.